Well, we had an event here yesterday. Get that on. It was Workers' Memorial Day, and one of the speakers, a president of one of the unions, said he was not aware that there was a Workers' Memorial Day. And then I began to wonder, how many of you are aware that there was a Workers' Memorial Day? And why would we even have a Workers' Memorial Day? And what struck me was the invisibleness, I guess, of the concept of workers. I mean, when we go into the convenience store, do we recognize that that is a human being on the other side of the counter, or is that somebody to serve our needs? And hopefully they're quick if there's a long line, and they're skilled and they don't dally. And if they do, I'm irritated at this entity behind the counter that's not serving me in such a way that I would like to be served. But nonetheless, maybe they're having a bad day. You know, maybe something's going on. And I'm not saying I'm good at all this myself, at ignoring the humanity of the workers in our culture. And they do seem to be invisible. I check the news programs on the television, usually an aggravating experience for me. This was the same because I was looking for something, for somebody to mention Workers' Memorial Day, to recognize the workers in our country. And here is a layer, many of us, a layer of human beings in our society that gets termed worker or working class. And it's often invisible. And we could say, well, no, it's not invisible. But we are sure, loathe is the word that's coming to my mind, but I'm sure that's the wrong word, or maybe not. We are sure not energized as a nation to ensure that this layer, this class of person has health care, has a living wage, has a pension, has a retirement, has time off to enjoy life. We don't seem to pay attention to that. How is it so that a necessary, absolutely a foundational group of people to our society have become invisible? So that's one of the things I want to look at today. The title of the sermon, what is the title of the sermon? Make sure I got the right sermon on my notes here. Escape, spirituality and escape, I believe, was the title. It's not even on there. So yeah, that's what it is. And it came to me when I was reading in my office some of the books. I don't know if you know Kenneth Patton, famous Unitarian Universalist writer, author. I mean, a person who some of his works are in the hymnal. And a person we admire, and when we want some inspiration, we might turn to his works for inspiration and for leadership. And I turned to, last week when I was here on Thursday, I turned into his book. It was a philosophy of religion book, and it was called, in the section called, The Reality of Freedom. And it begins with, "We are free. No presence or power in the universe controls us. All creatures are wild and free. They remain free until they are eaten by other free creatures. Fly and the bee buzz where they will. We intrude our traps, screens, repellents, poisons on creatures that suffer no controls. Wilderness reclaims the wild state everywhere, but where people deny it. We too are born free. That's simply not true. We are not born free. And thus the title to the sermon, Spirituality as an Escape. We are born helpless. We are born dependent. We are born needy. This is true for this physical infant that comes into our lives. Where's Sheila? I was going to say congratulations on her first Mother Day, but she's doing what mothers do, doesn't she? Isn't she? That it is not true that we are born free. And it may be that some sense of spirituality is our only escape. And when we read the works of Jesus, or we read the works of Buddha, and we read the stories about great religious leaders, one thing they are clear about is that their spiritual journey is not easy. You never read a person who has taken a spiritual journey, taken a religious journey to experience some sense of spiritual maturity, and read their story where they say this was an easy road. You just don't do it. You just don't find it. Every spiritual journey, when you read the stories, their report is this is a difficult road. This is a hard thing to do. And I was thinking, as we're here on Sunday morning, and how many years have we taken to put ourselves together? To put your sense of self together, to put your identity together, to surround yourself with things that affirm your identity. If you would go into our home and look in our library, it would be pretty clear how I think and who I am by what books are there and by what books are absent. You could determine that. Because we surround ourselves and we build in our homes and we build in our yards and we build in our communities things and ideas, and we gather people around us that affirm our identities, that affirm who we are, and it gives us a sense of belonging, gives us a proper sense of who we are in space and time, and how we get along with one another. And we might have fishing poles in our garage, we might have a boat in our garage, we might have big screen TVs, or we might have Miami football helmets, or we might have solar on our roofs. But all these things we put around us are extensions of ourselves and a reflection of our inner world and who we believe and think we are. You know, that's how it works. But so we take time and put ourselves together. Some of us feel good about ourselves. Some of us don't feel good about ourselves. However, and on the spiritual journey, what you will find in people's lives when they tell you that journey, is that there are chapters. And in the chapters of their journeys, when they learn something new and they have different experiences, they're able to let that identity go and they begin to construct a new identity, a new sense of self, a new personage. Along the way in their lives, there's chapters where they let go of the things that they valued and the things that they believe. And how is that? For an example, one of the heroes and founders of the Unitarian Universalist movement, Francis David, when he first started out, as a Lutheran. And then after some study, and he came to a different belief about communion, and that when they take the wine and they take the bread, they're actually taking the body and the blood of Jesus into them. And from Lutheranism, he read and he studied. He says, no, I don't believe that anymore. I believe that it's a symbolic act. It's a high religious act, but it's a symbolic act. But it's still Trinitarian. Both are still Trinitarian. But when he did that, he had to give up his entire community. He had to readjust how he interpreted the world. He had to readjust how he valued the things around him. And there were people in his previous community that did not like him changing. Not so much so at that point they would imprison him. But that's yet to come. So now he's a Calvinist. And he reads and he studies. and starts putting the world together a little bit differently, and he engages some people, and he leaves Calvinism. He becomes a Unitarian. He says, "No, I don't believe in this Trinity. I think there's a divine entity out there, and this man Jesus and the Holy Spirit, they're not equal to that." So now he's a Unitarian. So he has to leave once again. He has to leave his community. And then he thinks, wait a minute. And during the Reformation, during the times of 1400, 1500, 1600, during the Reformation, one thing that happened is that the church community said the Scripture and the person of Jesus is our strength, and that's what we're going to depend on. The reason they did that was to give them strength against an oppressive church and oppressive government. They said our authority is going to come from the person of Jesus, and our authority is going to come from the Bible. Our authority is not coming from the Pope. Our authority is not coming from the state. So it gave them a foundation to stand on. So Francis David said, wait a minute. This accentuation of this man Jesus, this adoration of Jesus, calling upon him in prayer, actually gets in the way of the experience of the divine. So once again, in his spiritual journey, he shifts. None of these shifts were easy, and all of these shifts came out of his personal experiences and his research. This particular shift, he did end up in jail, and it was a result. And being in jail, cold, damp, he did get sick, and he died. So how is it that I say now that this, as an infant, we are not born free, but indeed, in short order, we are born into captivity? And what in the world has that got to do with Francis David moving from Lutheranism, Calvinism, and to Unitarianism? There is a way of thinking about us human beings that in early on in Helen's and my work, when we developed a spiritual process about beliefs of us claiming ourselves to be blessed, known, good, loved as beings, we created part of that learning process a reflection on the stage that you were born onto. Now, prior to your birth, there's a story that's already going on. There are people there, they have particular emotional dispositions that could be pleasant, could not be pleasant. There may be a sibling there, so that when you're born, the sibling may have some feelings about your birth. Or you may be the oldest, you may have some feelings about the next sibling that's being born. So you're born onto that stage, but the way that we looked at that, we really looked at that as a family setting. And that there's a script in some senses that's already waiting for you to fulfill prior to your birth. Like for example, some people say, "Well, when does a mother become a mother?" And somebody answered, "When she was 8 and started to play with dolls as if they were her baby. That's when she became a mother. When's a father become a father?" The same way that we begin putting how we're going to relate to others, how we're going to relate to spouses or children, way before we actually have them. What that means is somebody's writing a script for that baby that's going to be born. But now, there's something that has to be added, because that family is in a situation where there are these values and this language that travel along in culture, and that I'm going to be born and I'm going to die, and that language and those values are going to continue on. So in a way, this language of this culture, as I'm born, can be in conflict with who I am, or can be in agreement with who I am, or can be neutral. But as I grow and as I receive instructions and teachings from family, from different people in my family, I engage this narrative. This narrative may be very oppressive to me. Usually it is. Here's how subtle it gets. In the beginning, let's say that I'm 6 months old and I'm cold. Now let's go 3 months, even 2. And I'm cold. My body's telling me I'm cold and I'm uncomfortable. What does a 2-month-old do when it's cold?
Right.
It cries. Okay. So the mother or the father, the primary caretakers here, and hears the cry and says, oh, well, the baby must be hungry. So the parent goes over, picks the baby up, and feeds the baby, and the baby stops crying. Now, the communication, I'm cold and I need to be warmed, gets answered with, let me give you food. Now, when somebody picks the baby up, holds the baby gets warm. So now we have a need of being cold answered with warmth and food. That's not direct. That's not clear. That's an additive. But the child can't communicate that. So the narrative of the parent's interpretation to the child, begins to determine the formation of that child, and now that child begins to get mixed up because cold body not only means warm, but it also means food. It means something other than it is. That's important to get because as children grow up, often they receive the message of what they want to communicate, and what they get is other than it is. So here comes this young child who's now 2 and 3, and begins to look on the television and says, oh, that's somebody that doesn't look like me. That's somebody who's a different color than I am. The child may be curious about that, but the adult's reaction to that image on the television that's a different color will determine the narrative of that child. The child's curious. But here comes this anger and rage. Now the child's curiosity and excitement about life gets dampened by, oh, that image equals negative feeling, hate, whatever it might be. All through the life, these things come on this child, and this child gets captured by the language and the value systems and the narratives that come through time. We're not born free. We're born captured. We're born indoctrinated. That's where we start from. And if that's not a belief that I can grab a hold of and understand, I might not be as motivated to take that spiritual journey toward freedom. But at the same time, we have this to contend with as well. In the work of Robert Lofton, he points out that there's a human trait that when people are anxious, they tend to find a belief system to calm their anxiety. And when they find a belief system to calm their anxiety, they hang on to that belief system. The more intense their anxiety, the more intensely they hang on to the belief system. And so for somebody to change their belief system, here's you've got anxiety, you've got a belief system between your sense of self and the anxiety. And so that whenever this anxiety comes up, you have this belief, you put it on the anxiety, and you feel better. If you're going to take that spiritual journey and let that belief system go, you're going to feel that anxiety. Rather than feel that anxiety, I'm going to destroy whatever it is that's telling me I've got to let that belief system go. Or eliminate it, or leave the church, or break up in the relationship, or say that's a political party over there, it's got nothing to do with me, so that I'm going to be okay. How do we gather ourselves to be willing to take a journey to freedom when we know we're going to experience anxiety, depression, isolation, rejection from others? That's a big thing to ask of people. It's not an easy thing to ask of people. We not only see this individually, we see this culturally. And I've shared this example before. I'll share it again. This is an example, so it's not political. Is that a way I can do political and get away with it? President Jimmy Carter, and if you watch the movie, what was the movie recently on Earth Day? I forget, maybe Earth Day movie, I don't know what it was. But and it reiterated some of the things we've been talking about for 6 years here. Jimmy Carter said to the nation, we're in trouble. We're dependent on these fossil fuels. These countries over here can hold us hostage. And we need to wean ourselves off of these fossil fuels. And as a matter of fact, I think it was 77 million barrels a day. I'm counting that, but it was something. There was 77 million. And he said, we're not going to import one more barrel of oil than what we're doing right now. If we're going to need more energy, we're going to come up with that energy from our country. Now, he was dependent on coal at that point. So it had its own problems. And he was saying, as a nation, we're going to have to slow down and we're going to have to take account of who we are. That was a very realistic assessment at that particular point in time. I mean, and look at what we've done since. So there's historical verification that, yes, the next president comes in and says, American people, during the election, American people, these people are telling you you got to slow down, life is not going to be as good as it was. Let me tell you, life's going to spring forth, America's going to come back, then I got this elixir, we're going to move on, it's going to be good. That was manipulative, putting elixir in there. Is that not what he said? It's exactly what he said. And what did we do? In our intoxicated state, we went, yes! The greatest president we've ever had. Deregulator, oil favoring president we've ever had. Look at the mess, look at the mess we're in now. Because we would not let the anxiety of the American identity deal with, we've got to reflect and make meaning, and we might go through some difficult times, but if we do that, it's going to be better for our future and better for our children's future, and we're going to do it now. Our psyche could not handle that anxiety and that identity shift. So the whole nation's got a spirituality that we've got to deal with, much less ourselves as individuals. Now, as Unitarian Universalists, I think we have a bit of an advantage in this quest. Our vision is to cultivate a sanctuary here, this place. Not just this place, though. But in your minds, in your psyche, in your imagination, when you leave this place, to know that you have a place where if you really want to engage in a shift in your belief system, and you really want to engage in a process of freedom moving in this direction, that's welcomed here. In this place, that's welcome. And hopefully we're mature enough to help facilitate that rather than impose our beliefs on one another. We are committed to providing a place of peace, love, personal spiritual growth, and service to the larger community. And I have to say with Harold that we did something yesterday, and I'm going to boldly make this claim so you can feel good about this church. We were the only church in Florida yesterday that honored Workers' Memorial Day. I think I'm safe. I think I'm safe in saying that. And hopefully next year that will not be the case. But you see, in the narrative in our nation, and in the narrative in our own psyches, honoring the worker and the worker class doesn't get attention, doesn't get positive affect, doesn't get positive emotion. We don't call attention to that. We call attention to other things. We call attention to a Tea Party. Now, I understand the outrage, and some I agree with. That's not a put down. But that's what we call attention to. We call attention to conflict, to diversity. We call attention to an oil slick that may be coming to the... But we do not call attention to the plight of the majority of the people in this country. It's not in our narrative. You see, as a child, and you're born into this narrative, and this narrative's coming upon you, right? The working class and the working person is not a high priority in that narrative. So we don't pay any attention to it.
But yet it's where millions and millions and millions of people live in this culture. It's invisible. So that narrative travels along. And we don't pay attention to it. What this church did yesterday was say, wait a minute, let's clear some space. And let's raise this voice. And let's put it out into the community. We videotaped him. We'll put it out into the community again. It's an effort of saying to this narrative, there's a voice that's not being heard. It's the same thing with us as individuals. We have been imposed. There has been a narrative imposed upon us that is about us. I should tell you this, since I have no family members here today, I can say this. I'll tell you this, and you'll start using it. In our family, my sister's 2 years younger than I am, and she, since, you know, Pammy do no wrong. Okay. And the other phrase is, Gregory did it. Pammy do no wrong, and say, Mom, Gregory did it. Which I probably did. Okay? To this day, humorously, but I also know that people really think I did it when I didn't. It's still there. To this day. From little on up. Matter of fact, Pamela said it yesterday as we were leaving from the restaurant. Pammy do no wrong. I mean, it's still there. And, you know, that's a humorous one we can look at. Well, it's humorous. I guess it could have taken a different tack and caused alienation between siblings and favorite one, not favorite one, and have to deal with that. But it's humorous. But how many of those have we received that aren't humorous? I can remember a 3-year-old boy coming to my office and said, I'm Mommy's bad boy. And he was serious. It was kind of a chuckle, but I'm Mommy's bad boy. I'm thinking, that's not good. You don't want a belief that I'm the bad one in your mind. Because you end up being the bad one. So we get these scripts in our spiritual journey. It's the things that we hold on to, even sacred beliefs. And, you know, when I talk to people that have an absolute truth belief system about God or about whatever it is, and I say, you know, on this spiritual journey, we have to organize ourselves within that we can let go of that. We may return to that and accept those beliefs as the truth after I leave them and evaluate who I am and where I'm in life and try to get some separation to that. I might say, oh no, these are good beliefs. No, I think they're right. And I've talked to some people. It's like a friend of mine that I haven't seen him for a number of years now. But when I said, well, can we talk about God and act as if there's no hell? Could not do it. Could not do it. But I mean, that was his belief, that there had to be. And I know that if you have a belief in hell and you believe that hell is an eternal fire and you believe that, I know in your imagination you have to have a place of your psychic energy that's on fire. Where there's torment. And I knew that about him. And I said, well, can we pretend for a minute that's not so and have this conversation over here? Get some relief from that inner torment. We all have inner torments that sometimes we cling to and don't want to let go of for some reason. But this spiritual journey does, that I'm talking about today, does call for us to organize our lives in such a way that we can find ourselves in a place, maybe in a group or with others or by ourselves, where we let go of our very identity and sort out, was that identity given to me from somebody else? And I just put it on like a coat, put it on like a shirt, and now I say, that's my shirt. That's my coat. Don't take that from me. That's mine. You know how we get? Don't take mine from me. And in the spiritual journey is about, let me put that coat down. Let me put that shirt down. Let me find out who I am without those words being put upon me and put in me. Let me take them and put them out of me to get an experience for who am I? Is that little infant who said with a cry, "I'm cold," and whose caregivers interpreted that as something else, is that little infant still cold? If their need was misinterpreted. Have you ever found yourself in a relationship trying to express a need and people are doing all other kinds of things, but they're not addressing your very need? Well, where does that come from that I didn't get direct or clear about my very needs? So today, in the next couple sermons, I'm inviting you to take a look at this way of spirituality, escape from what has been imposed or gently given or however that might have happened to you, to put that aside, and in the next couple sermons, we'll look at some other ways to do that.